Hey everyone, good morning and welcome to the new media show. And it is truly very early in the morning for our guest. We'll introduce him in just a second. But I'm Todd Cochran here, of course, of the new media show. And we've got Rob Greenley, my co-host, on the bottom square, as they would say. Good morning, Rob. How are you?
Doing fine. Good morning, good evening. I'm not quite sure. It depends on who's on this call and who's watching, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, I thought I had to get up early for a show because, you know, matter of fact, the alarm clock rang at 5 this morning and my wife punched me at 5:15. She says, "You're going to shut that off?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I better get up." But our guest this morning is Chris Jones, and Chris is actually in Tokyo this morning. And I must say, for being in Tokyo, you actually have am I seeing just a small sliver of an, you know, Tokyo apartments are generally pretty small. So are you in your Tokyo apartment this morning?
No, this is inside my house. This is my studio inside my house. I live a bit outside of the city, so I've got a little bit of land, not much, but a little bit.
Yeah, when you are, you know, I always laugh because when my wife's from Okinawa, so the first time that I went to her house, was very big. It was like almost bigger than an American style house. And I was shocked because having spent enough time in mainland Japan and being in Tokyo and, you know, some of the places there can be kind of tiny. Have you lived in Japan a long time or why? Or is your wife Japanese or just choose to live there or what?
Yeah, my wife's Japanese. Yeah, I moved here about 17 years ago. And we went back to the States for a few years and came back and really settled in now. So it's pretty much home for me.
Wow. you know, it's we've talked about it. We've talked about it several times. But I think if we ever leave Hawaii, we'll probably go someplace that's, I don't know. We've talked about moving into Asia during our retirement years and not necessarily Japan, but going someplace where one's dollar would be considerably extended, but that's just chitter chatter.
Might
talk.
Not be here.
No,
<That's for sure.
laughs> it's not, and it's not in Hawaii either. But anyway, we can talk about Tokyo all day long. But primary thing we got you on the show this morning is to talk about Trek.fm. So You run a Trekkie empire from Tokyo, so that's cool.
Yeah.
From the land where Star Trek is not at all popular. That's where Trek FM originates. Yes, indeed.
So if you, there's no Trekkie conventions or anything like that in Tokyo, I take it.
There's really not. In fact, you know, the new movie I got to screen it at Paramount. So luckily I have seen it myself, but for Japan in general, we've still got a month, more than a month, about 5 weeks to go before the movie opens here. So that might give you a little indication as to, you know, how popular Star Trek is in Japan. So, and the last movie made about $5 million here. So that gives you a little indication as well.
You know,
so Chris, why do you think it hasn't caught on there as far as the whole Trek thing?
I don't know. Yeah. It's a good question, Rob, because, you know, Star Wars is huge here. I looked at some numbers a while back. I think the Revenge of the Sith made about $88 million here, which is good here. And J.J. Abrams is big here. You know, Lost is very big here. But for some reason, Star Trek has just not caught on, and even the new movies haven't caught on either. I don't know. Maybe it's very deep. You know, it's the entry point to Star Trek can be really steep for people. And it could just be that.
And I think I know what it is. I think it's the nuances of the Japanese culture, because there's some stuff they just don't get. You know, my wife will be sitting, you know, watching a movie with us, and we will get a nuance on something, and either we'll be laughing and she'll be like, what was the joke? I mean, literally not getting it. Then I will have to go through and explain, and maybe, you know, the wittiness of some of the stuff that's in, maybe they just can't connect.
Could be. Or it could be Wesley. You know, maybe Wesley turned them off to Star Trek.
Wesley. It's all Wesley's fault.
Just never come back.
Wow. That's interesting.
Will Wheaton. Boy, I tell you, you can't do anything with him these days. No. So, yeah, so I'm curious. So why did you start this network? I mean, I'm just curious. Are you a big Star Trek fan yourself, or what kind of prompted this?
I'm definitely a big Star Trek fan. I've been a Trekkie since I was, I don't remember exact age, but probably around five, maybe in my great-grandparents' living room. I remember sitting and watching TOS when it was first coming out in reruns in the 70s. And I've just been a, you know, Star Trek fan my whole life, and I got very interested. I'm a designer, and I've worked in mostly in magazines. Actually, I started in print magazines. And so I've worked in media my whole career, going back about 20 years. And I got interested in podcasts when they first started rolling around about, I don't know, 2004, I think was the first one that I listened to. And it just kind of built up steam over time and over time. And I was sitting in here in the studio one day, and I'm a big user of Last.fm, if you know the music network. Yeah. Last.fm, and there was Blip.fm, and then a well-known expat here in Tokyo, Danny Chu, who his father, you know, is does issues. He's really into figures, and he was working on a site, I believe it's called Figure.fm. And I was sitting here, and I thought, I wonder if Trek.fm is available as a domain. I didn't really have any idea what I'm going to do with it at that point, but I just thought, yeah, maybe I'll check. And it was, and so I bought it. And that's when it started. That was April of 2010. So that's the short story.
You know, there's a lot of hardcore Trek fans. And I don't consider myself one of those, because I said something on my show one time. I don't know if it was the president that had just recently made a big gaffe. He made some gaffe and some reference to something. And I basically, on my show, I almost made the same gaffe. I'm saying, hey, but I don't claim to be a Trekkie. I'm allowed to make a gaffe. If I make a gaffe, please, you know, because, you know, you don't want to get the lore wrong and offend anybody. And we've got one guy in our network that does the Lou Trek show. Lou works with us, and he's been doing a show for a long, long time. So It's a genre. It's a, you know, that's very, very popular. But you know, the question is that I always have for these types of niche shows. Obviously, you got a new movie right now, so that helps with the content. But how do you keep the content rolling?
Some people ask that. You know, when our TOS editor, Drew Stewart, was on or talking to a friend recently, and he told some friends, you know, I'm on a Star Trek podcast network, and they asked him, well, what do you talk about? You know, just like you just said there, Todd, you know, there's a new movie out right now, but what do you talk about? And, you know, like Drew pointed out to them, well, there's over 700 episodes of Star Trek over 45 years. And
wow, is that many?
Because, yeah, well, there are 5 live action series. There's the animated series. There are 12 movies. There are, you know, over like 700. We have one show which focuses on books and comics, and there, I believe, are over 700 novels that have been written as well. Mm-hmm. And I may be wrong on that number, but it's somewhere up there. And because, you know, the central point of Star Trek is, as science fiction in general, is to talk about the human condition, talk about social issues, and to be able to look at ourselves within, in a way that we can't necessarily do if we talk about ourselves directly. You know, if we can transfer it over to alien cultures, it's a little bit easier to talk about touchy issues. And because that's one of the core premises of Star Trek, and there are over 700 episodes that you can look at, it's basically endless. You know, I mean, I could do this till I'm 100 years old and never do the same show twice, because there's just so much to talk about.
Well, yeah, and there's a lot of things that you can do around the actors and the work that they do out there too, that have been involved in the TVs and the movies and things like that. I know, you know, the Boston Legal TV show podcast that my wife did for like 3 or 4 years, you know, had William Shatner on the show. And the writers and producers of Boston Legal TV show were big fans of Star Trek. And one segment of the podcast that we did to cover the TV show was called Trek in the Courtroom. And it was like they always put in these subtexts into the flow of the show that had a connection somehow to things like you were talking about, kind of core principle points to Star Trek, right? So it's really permeated the culture in so many ways that is really hard for you know, for most people to actually see, but it's out there and it's in. I mean, I spent much of my younger years watching TV, watching those TV episodes, you know, like with my mom and my dad and stuff like that. So it was very much part of my upbringing was watching that TV show and the kind of the real human messages that was kind of given in that program was really inspiring. And I think it really touched millions and millions of people.
You know, I think I watched the original series as a kid too. But you know, I grew up, basically in the country, and we, you know, I would catch Star Trek like maybe once a month if I was lucky, because, you know, we worked and there was a time that when the TV blew up, it wasn't replaced, you know, so there was stuff to do outside. There wasn't stuff to do in the house, you know, so yeah. I guess probably that's maybe why, you know, I like the series. Don't get me wrong. I like, matter of fact, I like probably watching the reruns too from the syndicated stuff. And I don't know, do they still, even to this day, is the original series still syndicated? Do they carry on some?
I'm sure it is here in Japan, and I'm sure it is in the States as well. Of course, in the States, you know, Netflix has kind of taken over. Oh, so yeah. Star Trek is on Netflix, and you can pop in and watch any episode you want. Anytime you want, if you have Netflix, and
oh, that's handy.
You know, that's how, and it's been great for shows like Deep Space Nine, which kind of, Deep Space Nine is my favorite series, and I think it's the richest and best written series. It's quite different than the others in that it has a lot of conflict that Gene Roddenberry didn't want to have in Star Trek. But because of the placement of it, you know, it started during, I believe, the sixth season of TNG, and then Voyager started. You know, TNG finished after seven seasons. They went on. They started shooting Generations. UPN launched. I know everyone remembers Platypus Man, of course, as being the big show that UPN launched with. But it also launched with a little show called Star Trek Voyager. And Voyager came on, and DS9 was only on the air without another Star Trek series running alongside it for, it was just the autumn of that year, which I believe was 94, because Voyager started in January 95. So Deep Space Nine kind of got lost in the mix. It was kind of like the redheaded stepchild of Star Trek for a long time. And because of Netflix, people can go in now and they can just watch the episodes. And it's the kind of show that really benefits from rapid viewing instead of waiting, you know, a whole week to find out what happens next and go on and on. And so, so many people are rediscovering that show or discovering it for the first time now. And the same thing is happening with Enterprise, which was much maligned when it was on the air, because I think it wasn't really what fans wanted after Voyager. And a lot of fans gave up on it after a few episodes and they just didn't watch it. And now it's been, what, 8 years with no new Star Trek on television. And because of Netflix, people can hop in and they can watch Enterprise. And a lot of people are watching it for the first time, and they're talking to us and they're saying, you know, this series is actually really good. Why didn't I watch this originally?
That's funny.
Yeah.
So is this your full-time gig, or do you run the network on a part-time basis? I would imagine living in Tokyo, of course, as living in Hawaii, it's not necessarily expensive to live there. So what is your background? You obviously said you were in the media space before, but
yeah, it has become pretty much a full-time gig for me. I own a company called Stellar Debris, which is like an ad agency design studio, historically doing print design, marketing, web development. We've gotten more into multimedia. You know, I do a lot of writing as well. I'll do a lot of marketing for tech companies. And but over the past 3 years, Trek FM has become more and more a full-time gig. And so at this point, I mean, we have 12 shows. We publish one show every day, and some days we publish two shows. And I co-host four shows, and then I have a fifth show, which is just me, which is an interview show. So I mean, I'm on the air talking Star Trek about 6 hours a week. So people are really sick of my voice by now, I think.
Well, luckily you've got a great voice for the show. Then you do both audio and video, or
we do. Right now we're doing only audio. Now we have done some video in the past. We had a news show. I should say we have a news show, but it is on hiatus, called Hyper Channel, which is a video news show. But it's not the type of show we're doing here right now where, you know, we're sitting and talking. It's a very fast four or five story show. It takes about 5 to 6 minutes, and it's hosted by Tristan Riddell. But it's mostly video, and you see Tristan beginning and the end. And then it's his voice accompanied by a video the rest of the time. And that was actually the very first show on the network. And that ran for about 2 years, and it's been on hiatus for a little while now as we've put more and more resources into our audio productions. But in the future, I hope to do more video like I'm doing with you right now. That was my original vision for the network, but still waiting for the technology to, you know, settle in a little bit, because we have, our hosts are all over the world, all the way from, you know, California, England, Wales, Scotland, Australia. I'm here in Japan, so it's quite a juggling act that we do, and a lot of not everyone has internet connections with the kind of bandwidth that we really need for that.
Right. So how do you monetize the network then as well? That's a big thing. How do you pay the bills?
That's a big thing, right? We have some sponsors, and we also have an option for listeners to donate, and we have some, you know, original artwork and stuff that we do, because again, my company being a design studio, we have a wonderful illustrator named Isaac Zamora, who also goes by the name Tobu Ushi, who does a lot of just fantastic illustration. And so we have some of that stuff for people who want to contribute. So partially listener supported, partially sponsor supported. And in the long term, of course, we hope to be more sponsor supported. And because I come from a magazine background, you know, I model the network, even though I'm doing audio, the business model is fairly traditional print media model, but the content that we're producing, of course, is new media. And then we adapt that. I mean, the way we deliver the ads, you know, we do reads during the shows. We will actually chat about our sponsors and, you know, share our experiences using their services or products. I like that personally. It just feels like a better way to connect. And I think as a marketer myself, a better way to present content to the potential customers. So that's what we do.
You know, Rob, as I was looking at the website, you know, the first thing that really jammed out at me was the artwork. And, you know, obviously, you know, having a team that can produce fantastic artwork is, man, that's a large part of it. And, you know, you don't see this type of artwork on traditional new media sites. They just don't have it because, you know, the folks don't have the talent behind, you know, to have that done is very, very expensive. And, you know, if I tried to do something like that, it would look horrible. so, you know, and I'm just going through the different, so, you know, you guys have spent a lot of time on your artwork, which is fantastic. And I'm sure it leads credence to the site and helps, you know, validate. And I think part of it is the validation that, you know, this site's serious. You know, they are, you know, they're tracked to the core, and the artwork backs it up as well, you know?
We really are. I should put out here, this particular image you have here of Voyager. We also have one of DS9 Station, the Defiant, one of the NX-01. These renders are done by Tobias Richter at the Lightworks. He does there's one right there as well. He does a lot of work for the Ships of the Line calendar, which many Star Trek fans will be familiar with every year. And I believe he also did the 1701D that's being used in the TNG remastered Blu-rays, if I'm not mistaken.
Wow.
And Tobias has been kind enough to allow us to use his images for the cover art for our series-focused podcasts, which has been wonderful because it's allowed us to create a cohesive set of currently three, but in the future we plan to have five, you know, one for each of the live-action series podcasts, and make a family out of them. So we really appreciate Tobias.
Yeah, I
know.
Doing
that for us as well.
Yeah, I saw the credit on the bottom right-hand part of the screen that was on the images. So absolutely incredible that you can, you know, I guess for me, and I haven't really paid attention up to this space because, you know, I didn't realize that there was that depth of content. And, you know, that just shows you that I'm not a Trekkie at all. And maybe why the genre has been so endearing over the years is, and it's so, you know, hardcore because, you know, it's just, it's got that depth. Now, the question then is there going to be a Star Trek at any point for this generation? Is there going to be a new series? Any rumors? Any?
Pretty sure there will be. There are some rumors that I'm privy to that I can't share, but I have a feeling that something is coming down the line. I don't know when it might happen, but I just know that the, you know, you may not be aware of this either, but the ownership of Star Trek has been split. And in the kind of like the Viacom split up, CBS got the television rights and Paramount got the movie rights. And so it's a little more complicated because it's not one company who owns the right to just put Star Trek anywhere they want to. And so right now, when they signed JJ to do the movie that came out in 2009, they signed him and the cast to a 3-movie deal. And of course, after the current movie, Into Darkness has made, I know as of last week, it had made $445 million globally. So
wow.
I don't know what it is this week. Zachary Quinto said last week that Paramount has told the actors that they will be shooting the third movie in 2014. And I don't know if that's true, or they're hoping to do it, but clearly the amount of money that they've made so far has Paramount excited to go ahead and get this third movie out. Now, beyond the third movie, you know, JJ is taking over the Star Wars franchise.
Yeah.
So I don't expect to see any more J.J. Abrams, what I call the Abramsverse films after that third one. That's when I expect to see Star Trek come back to television. And 2016 will be the 50th anniversary of Star Trek. And I have a feeling that CBS is going to want to, if they do intend to bring Star Trek back to television anytime in the near future, what better year would there be to do it than the 50th? And so I'm hopeful that we'll see something. You know, what form that's going to take, no one really knows right now.
Can I talk a little bit, and Rob, I'm hogging the show here, so if you've got
it's
questions
okay.
for Chris, please tell me shut the heck up. So, Chris, you know, so far as demographic goes, where does your audience fall then? I'm sure that's maybe a hard thing to define. You know, in my head, I have a demographic that fits your audience. So what is it exactly?
Do you mean in terms of age groups?
Yep.
So I think it spans the range from teenagers. I mean, we have one host, Shervin, who's on our Star Trek Online podcast, Decade, who is under 20 years old. He's a teenager. He's the youngest. But I think in terms of the audience, it ranges from people like Shervin all the way up to people in their 50s at least, because mm-hmm. we have people who grew up with TOS. You know, we have listeners who saw TOS in first run when they were teenagers, or, you know, 12, 13 years
right.
old. And then we have a lot of new fans who cut their teeth on Voyager. Voyager was the very first series they saw. And that's because it came on when they were, you know, they were teenagers when it came on. So they were too young to be into The Next Generation or DS9. So it's a really, really wide range. And we even have some listeners who saw Enterprise as their very first series. And, you know, Enterprise came on the air in 2001. So it really runs the gambit. As for like the core age group, I would probably say it's people between maybe like 25 and 35 to 40 range.
Does it obviously skew heavier male, or do you have a pretty good mix?
I think it's a good mix. I know the people who communicate with us, the people who write into the show, the people who talk to us on Twitter, people on Facebook, it's just a very good mix. It doesn't feel heavily slanted either way.
Rob?
Yeah, I was just curious, you know, kind of backing up and looking at kind of more of a podcasting kind of view here. What are you seeing from an audience standpoint? I mean, you mentioned earlier that you're seeing a lot of listeners coming from, you know, other countries around the world. So are you seeing faster growth in those markets than you are in the U.S., or are you fairly saturated, do you think, in the U.S., or what are you seeing being in Tokyo? What's the market for podcasts outside of the U.S.? That's kind of my bigger question.
That's a good question, yeah, because I was listening to you, Rob, talking on a past episode of the New Media Show here. I think you were talking about how the Microsoft, the Zune store is pretty much U.S.-based, right?
Yeah,
it is. Seeing a lot more podcasts coming in globally.
Yep.
I don't know, you know, Japan itself, you would think podcasts would be huge here because people spend so much time sitting on a train commuting. You know, I used to commute 4.5 hours round trip every day to get to work and back home. So, but I don't know, you know, ebooks, podcasting have been catching on very slowly here. So I think that we're like the very, very, very early stages of podcast acceptance here in Japan. I mean, there are a number of podcasts that are produced here in Japan, in Japanese language podcasts. A lot of them revolve around entertainment, you know, music shows and such. So I don't know, but I mean, in terms of our audience, I think about 65% of our audience is in the U.S. and about 15% is in the U.K. And that it probably helps us that we have two UK-based shows on our network with the hosts are all based in the UK as well. And we have a number of listeners in Germany as well. I think it's our third largest. And then maybe Canada and Australia. And then other countries here and there. But we have, I mean, if I counted out all the countries, it's a lot in terms of our where we have listeners.
Like, so you think that it's not growing or something? I mean, what's your perception? Is it just that people don't know about it, or do you think it's not content that aligns with what most people are looking for around the world, or what's kind of your thoughts on that?
In terms of like the acceptance of podcasts,
exactly.
Japanese market, that it's not quite as accepted.
Yeah, I mean, I'm pretty sure that the client software is out there for smartphones, right? Or is it something, mm-hmm. do you think, that has to do with the capabilities of phones in those markets that those really advanced phones are not really that widespread yet in those countries?
I'm not sure. I mean, that's certainly not the case here in Japan because our phones are about a decade ahead of what was available in the States.
That's true.
Here, I think maybe it's just kind of culturally, you know, people spend a lot of time texting, playing games. Games on phone, feature phones, like not even smartphone games, but feature phone games are kind of popular here, which I've never quite gotten myself because it seems hard to play them on there. I think it's just not popular enough yet. You know, if you look, like, Facebook is a good example. Facebook was not popular in Japan. We have a social network here called Mixi, and Mixi was invitation only. So basically, to get into Mixi, you had to know someone who was already in Mixi. They had to invite you, and then you had to have a Japanese cell phone number in order to register. And so that was really popular for a while, but then Facebook started becoming popular. And now Mixi is really declining and Facebook is booming here. And Twitter is another thing. So I've been on Twitter for like 5 years, I think. And when I started, you know, Twitter was just not a thing in Japan at all. And a couple of years ago, it started to get popular. And now I believe that Japanese is the second largest used language on Twitter, I believe, are the statistics I saw. And so it caught on. Twitter is wonderful in Japanese, I should say, because in Japanese you can write a novel in 140 right. characters. So you can really express yourself on Twitter in Japanese.
That's great.
But so it catches on. So podcasts might be the same kind of thing. You know, when it finally reaches a saturation point, when certain types of entertainment here bridge themselves over into podcasting, and then maybe people will jump on it, and then it will kind of spiral out of control the way Facebook and Twitter have.
So if podcasts were to become popular there, do you think it would be driven by podcasters speaking Japanese, or would it be driven by English, or some combination of that?
I think that you're going to get some consumption of podcasts in Japan in English, because it's a great way for people to practice their English comprehension. Mm-hmm. You know, I tell people, Japanese people who are studying English, if you know, go to iTunes, go to wherever, you know, you get your podcasts, and find a topic that you're interested in, and find a podcast that you find interesting, and download it and just listen, and do that regularly, because just hearing the language will help you a lot. So you'll get some consumption that way. But for it to really explode, you know, for it to become popular in the way it is in the States now, I kind of feel like it would have to be Japanese language content, and it would have to be centered around TV shows, movies, music groups and such that are popular here for it to reach the kind of levels that we're accustomed to with the American audience.
You know, I've asked my wife, she's been working, she's got a book project that's been going on for 15 years. And not a page one has been written, but I have literally boxes, you know, several large boxes of, or she has several large boxes of material that is strictly nuances of American culture that you just don't see in Japan. And then also she's collected stuff that she's learned and I've learned by being married to one another, and the cultural differences. And they believe me, there are many, and there are many missteps in American marrying a Japanese woman, and I made them all. So, you know, she has all that documentation and all that data. And so I have pressed her for years to come on, let's do an audio show. I will just produce it and you will do it. And the biggest thing that she has said, and maybe it's a cultural thing, is that Japanese can be very critical. And not, you know, you just imagine everyone being polite, but when it comes to content and stuff being put out there, stuff, they can be very critical. So she's worried about the social impacts of putting out this content and putting yourself out there like that. And I said, well, we could do it so you would do it anonymously, and we could set up a pseudonym and all this stuff, you know, and she still wouldn't do it. I think it really has to do with even though they're very outgoing in some things, they're very reserved in others. It's just this weird oxymoron. But I don't know. I maybe think that's it. I don't think you'll see too many personal topical podcasts coming out of the Japanese market. I just don't. I don't see it.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think you'll see, I don't think it will ever be like it is in the US, especially where, you know, people like all of us on Trek FM, you know, we want to talk about Star Trek. So we all get together and we put ourselves out there and we talk about it and we share our opinions. I don't think it'll be that kind of thing so much. It'll be big media doing it. You know, it'll be, well, they already do a lot of them. It'll be NHK doing podcasts. It'll be that type of thing. It'll be, you know, I don't know, maybe Johnny's will get into producing podcasts related to all the musical acts that they represent, something like that. But it'll be like everything here is, it will be spearheaded by big media, big business. I think it won't be, you know, people sitting in their bedrooms with, you know, spending $100 on a decent microphone and just throwing shows out there. I don't think that will be so common here.
Yeah, my in-laws just, they don't get it still to this day. So I just tell them I do radio. It's in it,
you know. You have to do that sometimes too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Internet
radio.
Well,
it's a way that they can understand it, right? Because it is a lot like that. Yeah.
But it
makes sense.
But, you know, so there, but you know what is, if you think about it though, there is so much stuff in the culture in Japan that, you know, look at the anime scene. The anime scene is just incredible, you know, and if there was ever any content, and there's huge anime fans here in the US and there's people doing anime shows, but if you could get some of the leading anime folks to start shows there, those would just, you know, you would instantly have this incredibly huge fan base. And there's, you know, there's some genres like that there that would, I think would do very, very well, even with the U.S. audiences, you know, if they could be done in English, and that's the key, but maybe even accepted within the Japanese market, because it's been a while since I rode the trains there, and things have changed. Obviously we're in a digital world, but you know, I remember the days going by and I think you still do this, you go by the, you know, newsstand, and there's a 600 page comic book, and I guess they don't necessarily call them comic books. What do they call them? Is there a different word for them?
Well, it's manga.
Manga, yeah. And it's 600 page. I mean, it's just these tombs of, and you know, on the trains, you know, guys and girls are reading them. Is it all went digital at this point?
No, but you don't see it as much as you did 10 years ago. You know, these days people more have iPads, iPad minis,
right?
Smartphones. You do still see, and it's a generational thing too, though. You do still see older businessmen with the newspapers, and you do see, you know, middle-aged businessmen with these giant manga books that you're talking about.
Rob, have you ever seen one, Rob?
No, I have not. I don't. I have never been to Tokyo or Japan or Asia.
They're literally this thick, you know.
Wow.
So, yeah, and some of them can be adult in nature. Some of them can be, you know, like an action series. And so it just runs the genre. It really does. But
so, Chris, do you ever come over here to the U.S. and participate in Trek conventions or anything like that? Are you taking your shows on the road at all?
Not yet, but we're planning to do that. I was going to try to go to Star Trek Las Vegas, which is coming up in August this year, but you know, things just haven't quite worked out. It's a big endeavor.
Oh yeah.
Plus, you know, if I go over, it's not so much just for me personally going over, it would be a Trek FM thing to go over. So there are a lot of different aspects involved that didn't quite shake out. But in the future, I definitely will. I mean, I haven't been to the States in 5 or 6 years, so it might be a little bit of a culture shock for me when I step off the airplane. I don't know.
Things haven't changed that much, but yeah, I think if people just, you know, that haven't, you know, living in Japan takes on a life of its own. It's definitely different. I've spent a lot of years back and forth. And it's even going over for short times, like a month or so, and then coming back. It's always kind of like this, wow, hit me in the face type of thing, how diverse. You know, really, we're quite boring as Americans. be honest with you. We are. We're quite boring. And it's, you can tell the difference in, you know, how old is the Japanese recorded culture? You know, it's, you know, goes back many, you know, thousands of years. Yeah. And here we are in the United States. We're unculturalized, uncivilized beasts. People will take offense to that, but you know, if you travel to Japan, you'll understand what I'm talking about. It has this life of its own from community to community, for sure. So
we're just
go ahead, Rob.
Babies in the scheme of things, right?
So let's talk a little bit about your network then, and how you're working with your host. You've set up the network. You founded it. Did you go out and recruit shows? How did you find the producers? And you know, did you work a deal with them? Are they under contract? Can you reveal any of that? I'd love to know your inner workings of your network.
Well, it starts and ends with Twitter, I guess you would say, because I actually, everyone hosting a show on Trek FM is someone who I met through Twitter. And that's, it's amazing. You know, I mean, of course we talk off of Twitter, but in terms of like, how did we initially make contact, either accidentally, either because Trek FM put out a request, or not a request, or just a call, you know, for hosts, it all revolves around Twitter. And I was really into Twitter when I told you the story earlier about how I just decided to find out if this domain was even available in the first place. And I was already involved in Twitter quite a bit at that point. And so I started promoting what I was doing. You know, I set up the domain, that was April 2010. And initially the site, which you were browsing through earlier, was just a news journal that had maybe like 4 articles posted every week. And that was the Hyper Channel Journal. And that became the Hyper Channel video news show that I talked about earlier. And the news show started in December of 2010. So for the first 8 months, it was just really just this news journal here. Pretty bare bones. But I was planning the Ready Room, which is kind of our flagship show. It's our biggest show that has a big panel of lots of different people coming in and out all the time. And I was planning that first, but Hyper Channel was easier to launch. So I launched Hyper Channel first. And then the Ready Room, the way the Ready Room works is that it is a show of news and a feature discussion. And the Ready Room runs 2 to 2.5 hours. It's a pretty long show. And figuring out how we were going to do a panel show took a bit of time. And we were planning it, and I was getting closer, and I thought we were getting close. And then we had the big earthquake, if you remember the March 11th earthquake that hit us here in Japan, which here we call the Great Tohoku Earthquake. And that happened. And as a result of that, I met a guy named Greg Harbin, and we started talking about Japan. He was living in Sendai, right at the epicenter of the earthquake. And Greg and I were talking, and then we discovered that we were both big Star Trek fans, and we both were into podcasts, and that kind of settled in that we would co-host the Ready Room together. I hadn't really figured out yet who was going to co-host and how it was going to work. And that kind of spearheaded the rest of the network. And I met him through Twitter. As I just said, everything revolves around Twitter. And from that point forward, the show began to gain some traction. We started to get listeners. We started to talk more to more people. We started to meet more people. And then the panel started growing. And that show grew from being just him and me and maybe one guest on occasion to what we do now, where I always have a co-host and the co-host rotates, and then we have 4 people usually in the feature discussion. And those people, some of them started writing feature articles. Some of them started coming on as podcast panelists on the Ready Room, and that led to other shows. And from that point, you know, we've launched the next show that didn't involve me. The next show I launched after that was Matter Stream, which is my interview show. And it's not really about Star Trek. It's about arts and science and creative things, and they're things that are inspired by Star Trek. The next show after that we created was Decade, which is about Star Trek Online. But before that, I met Colin Higgins from England, and he does a show called Trek News and Views, and he was doing it by himself. And so it's the only show that we've ever brought into the network that wasn't started by us, and it came in. And then Colin and I created Decade together, and then he runs that show now. And he's joined on there by Thomas Baddeley and Shervin Sabeti, and now Mark McCulloch. And they talk about Star Trek Online all the time. And then after that, we launched our Voyager show, To the Journey. And that has Tristan, who I already told you hosts Hyper Channel, and then Charlene Schmidt and Laurie Sears. And they all met through Twitter as well. So it's all Twitter again. Mm-hmm. And that was in November of 2012. We had this flood of shows. We launched November 1st, we launched To the Journey. On November 9th, we launched a show called Commentary Trek Stars, which is also not about Star Trek. It's about the work of people who worked on Star Trek, but their work outside of Star Trek. So we try to cover like the complete gamut of anything related to Star Trek there. And that's hosted by Mike Schindler and Max Hegel in Chicago. So they're over there. And then on November 18th, we launched Literary Treks, and we had our friend Dayton Ward, who's a very well-known Star Trek author, come on as the guest to help us launch that. And I co-host that with Matthew Rushing. So that's like November 1st to 18th, we launched three shows. So we were kicking it into high gear or warp speed for the Star Trek fans out there at that time. And then in January, we launched our Deep Space Nine show called The Orb, which I co-host with Matthew Rushing as well. And then just last month, about 3 weeks ago, we launched our newest show, which is called Warp 5, which is about Enterprise. I co-host that with Kate Walsh, and she is in Australia. So she's only 30 minutes away from me. I'm used to all these people. The time zones are like 14 hours, 12 hours, 10 hours. And here's Kate, 30 minutes. That works. And you know, you mentioned the Boston Legal Show earlier, having William Shatner on. And for Warp 5, we were able to launch with Dave Rossi, who was the associate producer on Enterprise. And then the second show, we had Brandon Braga, who created Enterprise with Rick Berman on. And that's helped us to gain a lot of traction in iTunes as well, and kind of shoot up the charts and build a very large audience very rapidly. So that's the rundown of the network and how we all met each other through Twitter. So if anyone tells you Twitter is about people telling you what they're having for lunch, you can do a lot more with Twitter than just
that. Hey, have you guys had on any of the actual actors from any of the series on your shows?
We've had a few. Colin had Robert Duncan McNeil, who played Tom Paris, on Voyager, on Trek News and Views. And I've had Anthony Montgomery, who played Ensign Travis Mayweather on Enterprise, on Matter Stream. And I'm trying to think who else we've had. Any others at this point? Not too many yet. We've had more of the creatives, you know, the writers.
Sure.
You know, Brannon, Dave. We've had Rod Roddenberry on a few times. Doug Mirabello, Jose Munoz, who all worked on the show as well. But we're, you know, as we build our shows, as we build our audience, we're bringing in more of those people. Because it's very interesting to hear. I love hearing, you know, behind the scenes stuff. And of course, Larry Nemechek, who is he's the walking Memory Alpha. There's this website called Memory Alpha, which is named after what's supposed to be the kind of the galactic repository of information in the Star Trek universe. There's a website of the same name. And I call Larry the living, walking, breathing Memory Alpha. He is the Star Trek historian, and, wow. And he's a good friend of mine and a good friend of the show. And he's on our shows quite often, especially on the Ready Room quite often when we talk about the Next Generation in particular.
You know, one thing that I have learned, and you built your network very differently than I did when we first launched Tech Podcast. And, you know, one thing I for several years, it was controlled chaos, for a better word. And, you know, and we never really cohesed under a single brand. We have each show has their own brand and they're part of the network. It's kind of it's a secondary thing for most of them. And that's fine. That's kind of how we designed it and how it's run. But, you know, you've brought one show in. Does he still have his own .com, his own primary website, or did he completely come into the fold and bring the show around to your site?
It's completely part of our site. But his show was syndicated. Trek News and Views was syndicated elsewhere, like on Trek Radio and a few places, excuse me, prior to coming in. And so he's continued to maintain those syndications in addition to being part of Trek FM. Yeah,
syndication and distribution is always good. No matter where you're at, where you get the content, it's good. At least in my personal opinion. But so that's kind of cool how you've brought him in and brought the team together as one. You know, how do you define, you know, because some shows stick, some shows don't. You're going to know within a certain amount of time. So what do you give on a lifespan in a show to make sure it's going to rock? Are you going to give it 6 months? Do you give it a year? You know, how much time do you give a new show before you said, this one isn't working. Let's pull the plug.
You know, with our shows, unless I saw that we had like 20 listeners per show and it was taking 10 hours to do the show every week. I mean, of course that would be tough, but fortunately we don't have any situations like that. You know, for our shows, I'd probably just let them go on because I mean, of course, you know, we want to have a business model and we can't just do this completely for free forever, but we do it because we love Star Trek and we love to talk about Star Trek. We love to talk to each other about it. You know, it's great. I've seen every series over and over and over, and I know them all inside out. But when I sit down with friends and we talk about it, you know, I always see something new that I didn't think about before. They give me a new way of looking at a character or an episode, or maybe this is what the writer was trying to get at, and I was seeing something else. And just that by itself means that, you know, unless it's like really a situation where it's driving us into the ground because we need to be using that time for something else, you know, the audience doesn't have to be enormous. We do it because we love it. And so some of our shows are niche shows. You know, Literary Treks is kind of a niche show. It's books and comics. The Star Trek audience is enormous, but the percentage of Trekkies who are into the books, the comics, is much smaller. So I'm not expecting to get the same audience size for a show like that I would get for The Ready Room. You know, Mike and Max's show, Commentary Trek Stars, is a niche show. It's for people who love creative work and who really want to know more about what the writers or the actors or the producers of Star Trek have done beyond Star Trek. And it's a wonderful way for you to expand your horizons and discover work that you weren't familiar with. And you know, it's not going to get the audience numbers of our bigger shows, but I would never think of pulling the plug on a show like that because it has a smaller audience, because I think it provides a really great service. It's a really unique thing that you're not going to go and search for podcasts and find many things like that. And that's what we want to do with Trek FM too, is to provide great value and depth to the analysis and give people new ways to look at Star Trek.
One thing that I was thinking about as you're talking about, you guys weren't able to, you know, go out to Vegas this year. One thing that I found, and just a little advice, I think it would behoove you, if you can pull it off financially, to go to some of those big events like that, because I think what you're going to find is that the connections, the additional connections and show building that you'll be able to do at one of those events will probably exceed what you think is potentially possible. Now, you'd have to plan it. You have to plan your execution of that to get the most value, but From what we saw from, you know, from our team, from doing different events, that were in the genres that, you know, that we report on, those, I call those types of events, gifts that keep on giving all year long. It spawns, new ideas and, new, relationships and new sponsorships and, a whole variety of other, superfluous stuff that you wouldn't really think about over the long term, from a connection standpoint. So, you know, if you guys get to the point where you can go, to these events on a regular basis, I think it's important to have your face, at these events a couple times a year. I think you guys would well pay off, you know, and when we started going, it was a stretch, you know, it really was stretch financially. And then when we finally kind of figured out what the end value was, we said, oh, man, you got to be there. Now, we've had to make adjustments over the years. Sometimes we scale down, scale up. This coming year may be a scale down year, you know, from some of the stuff that we're doing. But it's really paid off in huge dividends.
Right. Most definitely. We're going to have some representation at Star Trek Las Vegas this year, and that some of our hosts are going. So they'll be able to spread the word. That's good. Person to person. But like you say, in the future, and certainly next year, we'll have to, you know, have a presence. You know, I want to have a table. I mean, I'm used to doing this stuff actually because I market for technology companies. And you know, part of what I've done for technology companies over the years is designing the booths for the expo floors and designing, you know, the multimedia that plays there, planning all the marketing that surrounds that and the giveaways. So
we need to talk.
It's definitely something that you want to be doing.
You know what?
Most certainly.
And you may be surprised. You might be able to reach out to those show organizers and you might actually be comped space, especially if you're doing content while at the show, covering the show with people that are at the show and even vendors at the show. You might be able to score yourself, save yourself $3,000-$4,000 at least in a booth cost.
Yeah. Well, that, and also I'm sure some of those have like maybe panel discussions or things like that, that you might be able to get on a panel or even, I know I've been to Comic-Con and there's, live recordings of a podcast episode that's done in front of a live audience kind of situation
too. Yeah, that's something
we
want to do too.
Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of fun.
Rob, do you have any additional questions for Chris?
Yeah, Chris, what are you seeing as far as in the overall kind of landscape, or what are your thoughts and opinions about kind of the current podcast distribution platforms and apps, and what's your philosophy on that? Are you getting all your shows into all of the platforms out there, or are you targeting ones? I know you sent me a list that kind of brought us up current, but you know, from a distribution standpoint, what are you seeing out there?
In terms of what I'm trying to do, of course, I want to get the shows into every possible distribution channel, make sure all the shows are there. I find that our Android listeners have the hardest time, I think, listening to podcasts. I don't hear from our listeners who are using Windows Phone. I do hear from a few people who listen on Xbox, and I know a few of our shows were already on Xbox, and I think not all of them were, so that's why I had sent you a message about that. I would love to see, as a podcast producer, you know, and as a content creator, I would love to see Google support podcasting on the Android platform in the way that Apple supports podcasting on the iOS platform, because it's just not there. And the options for people to listen to podcasts on Android are much more limited. And I think just the delivery mechanism is less reliable. You know, where do you go? You know, you have to, of course, you can get our RSS feed, you know, if you're techie and you know how to do that, that's great. But, you know, I think a lot of people who have Android phones these days are people who they took their feature phone in because their contract expired. And they said, I need a new phone. I need, my contract's up, and AT&T or Verizon or whoever just handed them an Android smartphone and they left with it. And they're not really techie people, so they don't quite know what to do. So if they can't easily just download an app like Downcast or Instacast or Podcast or whatever it is on iOS and just type in the name of the show and get it, it's kind of tough. So I'd love to see Google support that a bit more than they do right now.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly a huge amount of smartphones out there that are just not being used for podcasts because of that. I totally agree with you.
And for one thing that we do, actually, and I heard this question come up on another show I was listening to recently, we produce two versions of all of our audio podcasts. We produce an AAC version and an MP3 version. Because we do enhanced podcasts, we actually take the time to put chapters into most all of our shows. A lot of them, we put unique artwork for each chapter, especially like the Ready Room, where we talk about news. We'll actually put the artwork of what we're talking about in that chapter. And we put hyperlinks as well, so you can tap your screen and you can go through and get more information. And, but that has to be wrapped in an AAC format. And we used to only publish that format, but we've started for the past, I don't know, year or so, putting an MP3 file out there as well. And the main reason we do it is we do it for BlackBerry users, because we had BlackBerry users telling us that we really want to listen to the show, but I can't, you know, my phone won't play this format. Mm-hmm. I've got to have an MP3 file. And so we do it. And, you know, MP3 downloads make up less than 1% of our downloads.
Wow, that's incredible. Because that's completely opposite of the rest of the space. It's... Wow.
Is it?
Yeah, because, it, you know, matter of fact, we discourage people from even using that format. Wow. I'm surprised.
From using the MP3 format?
No, using AAC.
AAC.
Because you're limited in your devices that you can listen to it.
Yeah. That's why we do both.
So you have an option. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. And I think I also heard last week, too, that Apple may be starting to remove the capability of the enhanced format as well. So there may be a path towards them kind of pulling that out of the software because it's just not being used as much.
Yeah. I hope they don't. You know, like changing artwork or hyperlinks, yeah, I can live without that. But, you know, you take a show like The Ready Room, which is 2.5 hours long.
Yeah.
I don't want to give someone a 2.5 hour file and they just wander their way through it. You know, I want to take the time. Here are all the news stories. If you don't want to listen to one, you can skip it. It's fine.
Yeah.
Here's our feature discussion. Yeah, we talked for last week, we talked for an hour and 22 minutes about Spock's brain, which I don't know how we managed to do that, but we did. But I don't want someone to have an hour and 22 minute file to listen to us talk about that. I want them to be able to remember, you know, they can jump to a spot. So we'll put like 5 or 6 chapter markers in an hour and a half discussion like that. I think it's good for the user. You know, again, I'm a designer. I came through the ranks designing magazines. I'm used to designing, you know, it's information architecture. It's how you organize the book, how you make sure people can find the information they need. And I take that approach with my podcasts as well. And I'd be really bummed if Apple,
you know,
for no good reason that I can think of, removed that capability. So hopefully those are just rumors, kind of like the ITV.
I think the reason is because out of 1,000 shows, maybe 1 or 2 are using that format. So, you know, I'm serious. I don't see it. When someone tells me they're doing an enhanced podcast, I'm like, why? You know, because I understand your design needs or wanting to do, but generally people are listening in their car. There's not an interactive thing going on the screen. You are just, you know, you're listening, you're plugged in. I understand with a long show, the reason you want to do that, but you know, but if you have an Android device, you're not going to be able to listen to that content. And it's not going to have the same effect as having it on an iPhone. So, it's good that you're doing it. It's interesting. I was literally floored here to hear that you guys actually do that. So I talked to so few people that do.
Well, we actually have
it's not that that it's not needed. It's invaluable. Just that it's just not widely supported on the playback platforms, and that's part of the bigger issues. I know it's none of that's supported on the Windows Phone side either. So it's BlackBerry can't do it, and I know a lot of Flash players can't do it, and I don't believe that the HTML5 has any capability around that either. So you're really limited to playback in a very, very limited amount of, well, I shouldn't say limited. There's millions of devices out there that are capable of playing it, but it's primarily only on Apple.
Yeah. One thing that you should, you know, one thing we have always said is that and one thing I was kind of surprised, I was looking at your show notes. You really don't have show notes. You have episodes, but there's very little metadata that go along with a specific episode. Unless I'm missing something, and let me
drive in. It depends on the show.
Yeah, and typically...
Some of the shows are like half hour, pick one topic, talk about it, so there isn't much to go along with it.
Gotcha.
If it's a new show, you know, we have... the links to the original news stories.
Gotcha.
Of course, we have our sponsor information and such.
But okay.
Now, we have very extensive show notes that we use on our side, you know, to prepare the show and put it out there. But we don't put all that on the public side show pages because we just, it's just not my design style to overload in that way.
Yeah,
it's not
the only concern is you're missing out on the SEO. So that the
I think a lot about SEO, of course, because of my marketing background. So I think, you know, when I'm writing the synopsis, and if it's a news item, which words I use in the headlines, for example, I think about that as well, as long as those are in there. And I don't know, we've been quite successful in the rankings with what we're doing.
That's
so
good.
but yeah, I know what you mean.
Well, it's looks like you guys have done very well, and for the short time that you guys have been up and running, which is good, and it's nice to see a new network be able to, you know, garner some success, and I really think these niche topical networks are really important. I've been saying this since about 2005 that, mm-hmm. you know, niche networks are really kind of where it's at, and having a core group of shows, you know, you can gain a lot of traction, you know, cross promotion, all that stuff that goes on, where there's so many lone wolves in the new media space that just want to do their own thing. And I think if they would realize the value of being linked up with more of their cohorts and then working together and cross promoting and doing that actively, really can pay off a huge, huge dividends.
Well, yeah. And it does kind of beg the question here, is there opportunities to do similar things to what you're doing for other kind of longstanding series, you know, like maybe the James Bond series is there, I don't believe there's any podcast network that's trying to follow that.
that devoted just to James Bond.
Kind of,
I thought you were going
exactly.
to say Alf.
And is there opportunities for others to actually get involved in this space? And I don't know, Chris, what do you think?
I think there is. I think it depends on the subject matter. The reason it works with Star Trek is, as we talked about earlier, there are so many episodes of Star Trek. There's so much content that you can dig into. You know, Star Wars, for example. You know, could you do a network like this devoted to Star Wars? Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't think you could do a network that has 12 shows that are all revolving around Star Wars and do it for, you know, 10 years or more every week, because there are only 6 movies right now, and there are a lot of novels, and there's the Clone Wars TV series, and there's some stuff, but the content depth isn't the same as Star Trek. And so, like James Bond, you mentioned as well, there are a lot more James Bond movies. And I mean, you could do a James Bond one for a set amount of time, but would it be like a perpetual thing that you can just keep going and going and going and make it a network that has a lifespan of you know, 10 or 20 years. Because I'm, you know, building Trek FM is not something that I'm planning to do. I've been doing it for 3 years. It's not something that I'm planning to do for 3 more years and then I'm done. It's something I'm planning to do pretty much forever because there's just that much stuff to talk about. So it'll keep going. And it just depends on the content matter. You know, I think maybe something like Doctor Who, you might be able to do something like that because there are so many seasons of Doctor Who if you go all the way back, something like that. Or you pick a topic like science fiction and you do it about science fiction television, or you do broader science fiction, or you do science fiction literature. You know, that's something where there's so much material that you could build a whole network around it.
Yeah, I think that there's definitely a lot of untapped areas that haven't been explored in this era, you know, in this kind of genre of creating content that just hasn't been explored yet.
You know, and I think that it just shows that there's plenty of opportunity in space. And you know, but the key, I think that ultimately the key to all of it is you got to pay the bills and you got to be able to keep the lights on. And I still think, as much as one person may love a topic, you can talk about it a lot and spend a lot of time on it. But you get a year, 2 years in, and it has to start paying some bills.
Todd, I don't know if that's entirely true. I think that, if you look at really the backbone of the podcasting kind of non-business, I should say, is hobbyists, people that are just doing it because they want to put out content and it's fairly easy to do. And I mean, I know I see shows sent in to me all day long that really have no business model, but are just doing it because they love the subject, or they're doing it to support some consulting business that they're doing, or they're trying to sell a book, or they're trying to become an expert in something. So business models take a variety of forms. It doesn't necessarily come directly from the show.
Well, you know, I also look at it from a longevity standpoint. If the show doesn't have a business model, there's very few shows that started, I can probably put them on one hand, that started in, you know, the beginning, 2004, 2005 time frame. They're still doing shows that are not, haven't been monetized. Now, it may be good for, you know, these shows may last a couple of years.
Sure.
But, I think if you want something that's going to be sustainable and basically looking at a 10-year plan, and maybe people don't look at it that way. Maybe I was the only one that did from the beginning. I was really, in the mode of, this was going to, and I guess if I was just doing it as a hobby, the goals would be different. And also my dedication level would be different as well. But if you're going
I think it depends on how you're doing it. I think to Rob's point, it depends how much time you're putting into it. You know, if it's a topic you love and you're spending, let's say 2 or 3 hours a week planning, recording, putting the show out, maybe it's a half hour show, and you have a great day job and you can fit that in, then maybe you just keep doing it and you don't care if it makes money or not. But in my case, and I think in your case, probably Todd as well, we're both approaching it from, I guess, a background of looking at it as a business in the first place. And so building it in the same way that we would if we were building any kind of business venture, structuring it that way. Of course, it may, it's not making money right out of the gate, but it's designed in that way. So it depends on how you're approaching podcasting. It can be a media business for you, new media, or it could just be a hobby. And I think more people approach it as a hobby. Probably the majority of podcasters approach it as a hobby. If you just go to the directory of podcasts and you just search, the vast majority of them are a couple of people who just want to talk about a topic they love. Fewer of them are being produced with the goal of building it into a business. And then the third group, of course, is the stuff that is being produced by big media to start with, all of the stuff being produced by the big networks in the first place. And that's, of course, already supported.
Right. So.
Yeah, and I do kind of wonder about the whole phenomenon. I've been thinking about this a lot lately too, and it can be a little bit kind of a downer or a negative thing, but that there seems to be a growing level of kind of overall media noise on the web and the internet. And yeah. As that kind of grows, it's becoming more and more difficult for a podcast or any kind of new show that starts to get any kind of audience or following. Because it does seem like what's happening with Facebook and Twitter, if you really back up and you think about it, there's a lot of people talking, but it feels like the more people are talking, the fewer people are listening. And I don't know if that is that could be a problem for podcasting in the long run.
I don't know, maybe. I remember when podcasting was first kind of taking hold, the very first podcast I listened to, I believe it was 2004, was the MacCast, which I'm sure you guys probably know, with Adam Christensen.
Yep.
And Adam is actually the reason I got interested in podcasting in the first place, because his show was the only show I listened to for a couple of years in terms of podcasts. But back then, if you went into the iTunes store when they first put podcasts in and you searched, it was a lot more, it wasn't big media stuff, right? It was a lot of smaller stuff. And if you put out a new show, you could get exposure. And the new and noteworthy was stuff being produced by just, you know, everyday people. And then it got to the point, you know, now where the new and noteworthy, it's all big network stuff. You know, we've been really lucky with the launch of Warp 5 that we got all the way up to number 3 in TV and film as the number 3 top podcast after launch. And we've been there in the new and noteworthy. But everything around us was, you know, Universal Studios and Sony Pictures and NPR. And it's all this like big media stuff. And so it's really, really difficult for you to get any exposure these days, because it's been taken over by big media. And then below that, like you're saying, Rob, there are so many shows now and there's so much noise being produced. And I don't mean noise to say that what people are doing is bad or anything, just the volume level. There's just so much quantity of stuff that it's hard to cut through and get attention. And especially when you're having to do it on a layer beneath all the big networks now, because they get all the exposure in the directories.
Yeah, and I feel this constant pull. I know Todd and I have talked about it on the show too, of the content providers are more and more feeling like they need to produce shorter content because people have less attention spans, right? Yeah. You know, like this show, you know, we go like 90 minutes every week, and I know that there's a lot of content people out there that'll tell you that that's way too much content for most people to consume these days. So does it kind of drive us in this direction of making shorter content as a way to appeal to a larger audience because of that short attention span and because people just it's so difficult to get somebody's attention for that long?
Could be, depending on the content. I mean, that's one thing that we've done. These people who think your show is too long, they're going to really think the Ready Room is too long.
3 hours, right?
Well, it's typically roughly 2 hours, but I would say 2 to 2:15 is the average. And we've had a few people who have said that, you know, I'd like to listen to the show, but it's 2 hours. I just don't have time for that. I remind people that, you know, you don't have to listen to the entire show in one sitting either. You can listen to part of it now and part of it later. That's one reason I like the enhanced podcast format, because I can break the show up for people. But to counter that, also what we've done is with the shows that are devoted to individual series, because the Ready Room covers all of Star Trek, with those other shows, we've made them shorter. So it's like we have this one big show that you can jump into and you love Star Trek and we're going to cover so much material. But, you know, if you love a different series, you can hop in and it's like 30 minutes or 40 minutes. You can hop in and we have a little show as well every week that you can consume for that. And we actually, I mean, we have listeners that listen to all of our shows. So they really love Star Trek. one thing really that, tired of hearing my voice.
One thing that, you know, I've always said is if the content's good, the audience is just, they don't care. You know, some of the most successful shows that are on the networks or on the podcast space right now are long shows. They are not short 10-minute shows or not 20-minute shows. They are 1, 2, and in some instances, 3-hour shows. You know, I do an hour 15 on my personal show. It's never hurt me from an audience standpoint. But I also fully understand that I am a 2-commute show, or I might be a single commute and they may not listen to the entire show. But I do know that what segments they listen to, and I make sure that the content I need to get to them is in the segments that they're listening in. So I think it's all on formatting too. So if you format your show a certain way, as long as that format doesn't change, they will know where to go in the show to get the specific format there or the specific piece that they want of it. Now with you guys, you know, you make that simple with the AAC, with the enhanced format. But quite frankly, I don't know how anyone has the time. You know, I personally, I don't have the time to be able to go through and do all that post-production. My post-production is really the blog post and a post. It's less than an hour. See,
yeah, well, I do it during editing. I create the chapters during the editing process. So I roll it all up together.
So you actually edit your audio then? I mean, you actually go through and, we never edit. And there's no time to edit.
No, for me, again, you know, being a designer, I was telling someone this the other day, I approach my shows as I'm creating something. Uh-huh. I'm creating a design with it. And so so I edit everything. I'm really picky about transitions, the timing of transitions. I'm also a musician. I'm a classically trained musician. I played professionally for 7 years in orchestra, actually. And so I everything's musical to me. So even the spoken podcast is musical to me. And I will actually, I know it's anal retentive, but transition from one segment to another, I'll actually, sometimes I will count beats in my head.
Wow.
That the timing has to be just right. Or if there's music, the voice has to come in a specific spot with the music, or it doesn't feel right to me. So yeah, I do take a great deal of time doing editing. But during that process, I also mark off where those chapters are. So when I bounce my final cut, that metadata is already there in the file. So when I take it over to GarageBand to do the enhanced, it's already done.
I just how many hours do you spend editing a show?
A lot. It depends on the show. It depends on the topic. Like the Ready Room has a lot of gags in it, has a lot of over the course, because we've done 104 shows on the Ready Room now. And so over the course of this, like 2.5 years, we've gotten a lot of in jokes, a lot of gags and stuff. And so I have splice audio in. And so that takes more time, you know, because I have to be listening for when I'm supposed to put it in, and then I have to put it in. Other shows where it's more straightforward, you know, like The Orb, for example, where it's a straightforward discussion. I don't know. I mean, if the show's an hour, you know, I probably spend like an hour and 20 minutes editing. I do a rough cut where I don't really listen. I look at the waveform, because I can tell from the waveform, like if it's someone saying or if someone's coughing or clearing their throat or whatever. And I just quickly go through and I draw my I mute a lot. And so I go through, I do that really quickly, and then I bounce that stuff out. That's my rough cut. So.
You couldn't handle my process. I cut each end, I equalize it, and I save. This show will be in the can 5 minutes after we get done recording today.
Yeah, I know. I'm not like that. It takes me a good bit more time.
Yeah, thing is, though, what I have found too, and don't take this the wrong way, I found shows that heavily edit don't last.
Oh, really? Why is that?
Because there's so much work.
Yeah.
You know, so much work. And you spent 3 hours recording and you spent 3 hours editing, and you know, it's like, and the next thing is at least in my instance, my wife is like, why are you still in the studio? You know, why aren't you out here helping with the kids? It's, You know, it's really one of those, you know, like, come on, you know, it's enough is enough. So,
Todd, yeah. It's a survival strategy is what it is. It's
Well, it's the only reason that's why this show starts at 6 a.m. because my kids are going to be waking up in a few minutes. Show will be done. Dad's going to be available for the weekend. Otherwise, I wouldn't, you know, weekends would be very, very tough. That's also why I record at 8 o'clock at night.
Yeah. My recording schedule is based around my kids' schedule quite a bit as well.
And of course, your time zone thing probably drives them crazy too, but we've got you up at 2:30 in the morning Tokyo time. So, Rob, any final thoughts here before we wrap this up?
Yeah, Chris, I wanted to say that I think we're kind of kindred spirits around the whole editing thing. So I've been doing that kind of stuff for years myself, and I think it comes from my years of doing my broadcast show that had to be cut up into 6 segments down to the second, and we had to go into each of those segments of the show and cut out all those ums and ahs based on trying to hit that that second count for just before the commercial break. So I tend to do the same thing, especially when you create a show that is like pre-produced and you want to piece it together with conversations with other people and you want music and you want transitions and all this kind of stuff. It's difficult to do that without a lot of post-production work. And that sounds like that's what you're doing here. And I tend to do that with the shows that I produce as well. Because they're kind of like a jigsaw puzzle to me. They're not doing it. I don't typically do shows live. This is really the only show that I really have ever done that's a live podcast. Because I tend to agree with you, and I also do it because I respect the audience, that I'm trying to save them as much time and give them the most value and make it sound the best, right? So I think I agree, but I also agree with Todd too, because there's a place for both production processes, and I think it just depends on what you feel most comfortable with.
One thing that I found too was that by doing live, it made me better from a content creator standpoint. I had to know this is what we're going to do. There is no second chances in live. It is what it is, and. You know, there was, of course, I never gave myself very many second. You know, and when I wasn't live, if I really made a big screw up, I could cut something out. You know, and I would do that periodically. Well, you know, one in 25 shows, I'd cut some. That article really sucked. Let me go back and just cut that segment. And and I would do that. But today, I never do that anymore. So, you know, that's, you know, again, is that caused me some audience share? Maybe. I don't know. But anyway, we're getting into the 1 hour and close to 1 hour and 30 minutes here. So, Rob, who's on tap for next week?
Oh, that's a good question. Let's see. Let me pull it up here really quick. We have Rick Calvert, the creator of the New Media Expo, is going to be on the show with us next week.
That should be really good. I had a phone call with Rick just a couple of days ago on the 2013, I think, 9th Annual Podcast Awards. So we had a discussion with him about that. So the Podcast Awards ceremony will definitely be coming back to the New Media Expo again. I've got to, you know, got to get my brain engaged to get ready for that. That's a big undertaking every year, but it's going to be fun having Rick on to talk to him. And I know you've lined up some fantastic guests over the next couple of weeks too. So folks will want to definitely stay subscribed. But contact email, it's either Todd or Rob, not one. It's Todd@newmediashow.com, Rob@newmediashow.com. Feel free to send us an email, provide us feedback. A lot of people are contacting me straight up on my regular email address that most of you know me by, and that's fine too. And we've been getting some show feedback. I definitely appreciate it. And what's interesting, Rob, is when I'm talking to people, I'm getting the, hey, I'm listening to your show. Wow, great stuff. Keep it up. And then I'm like, okay, send us comments. So please, please send us comments throughout the show. And if you have feedback for the show, we'll definitely put it on the air. Chris, thanks for staying up late.
Yeah, yeah, thanks, Chris, for doing this.
Thanks for having me on the show. It was a lot of fun.
And it's a Sunday. It's actually, yeah, you're Sunday morning there soon to be. So
it's 2:35 a.m. on Sunday morning. That's right.
So we'll let you get out of here and get some sleep. But everyone, make sure you get over to, let me put the website up one more time and go to the homepage. Go over to trekfm.com. Definitely check out their series of
shows. Just trek.fm. Trek.fm.
Yeah, trek.fm. Sorry. Yeah, trek.fm. And subscribe to them on their Facebook page, Google Plus, Twitter, iTunes. Get hooked up with the team over there.
Yeah, we're everywhere. You just, iTunes, just search trek.fm and you'll find all the shows there. If you go over to the site, there's menu on the menu bar. It says shows, and if you drop down, it says podcast directory, and all the shows are listed there along with little buttons that, you know, you can go to iTunes, you can go to Stitcher, you can get the RSS feed, you can if you go to the show page for different shows, a lot of them now, they have MP3 buttons underneath the streaming player as well, so you can just download a normal MP3 file as well. So,
yeah, and if you're a Windows Phone user, all the shows are now in the catalog. I think I only had like half of them before.
Yeah, I think a few of them were there. So yeah, so you can get them, I guess, Xbox, Windows Phone now as well. And so pretty much everywhere. And then, of course, on Twitter, we're TrekFM.
Outstanding. Well, thank you, everyone, for listening. And, Rob, any final comments?
Nope, I think that's about it. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at Rob Greenlee. And if you're a podcaster and you don't have your podcast in the Windows Phone podcast directory, send me an email to podcasts@microsoft.com, and I'll be happy to add it.
And of course, you can follow me at Geek News on Twitter as well. And I think Chris, we had your stuff up earlier.
I am on Twitter. I am C. Brian Jones, the letter C, and Brian with a Y. Right. So I do go by Chris, not Brian, but you know, this is a username that I discovered I could get everywhere in social media. And so it works for me. So I use my middle name for that.
And smart.
I'm consistent. And then I've got my own website is cbrianjones.com as well. So
there's not very many Chris Jones in the world. So that's not a popular name at all.
Not at all.
All right, everybody. Thanks for being here. We'll see you next week on the New Media Show. Todd Cochran and Rob Greenlee. We'll see you next time.
Okay, bye.
Aloha.